a 14-year veteran of the Los Angeles Police Department. Coon faces the most charges: assault with a deadly weapon, excessive force by an officer, filing a false police report, and trying to conceal the alleged crime. While Coon did not strike Rodney King with a baton, as the highest-ranking officer on the scene, prosecutors allege that he directed his officers to do so. Officer Timothy Webb, a rookie on the Los Angeles Police Department. Webb is seen on the video kicking and hitting King about 15 times, although the exact number is unclear. He is charged with assault with a deadly weapon and with excessive force by an officer. Finally, Officer Theodore Briseño, a 9-year veteran of the Los Angeles Police Department. Briseño is charged with assault with a deadly weapon and with excessive force by an officer. Prosecutors claim that Briseño kicked Rodney King. And it's the tape that prosecutors will use as the linchpin of their case.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Just to reintroduce myself, my name is Terry White. I'm a deputy district attorney for Los Angeles County. I'll be one of the prosecutors in this case.
In his opening statement, Chief Prosecutor Terry White sets a scene. He describes how the incident began after California Highway Patrol officers spotted King's car.
Melody Singer drove on the 210 freeway eastbound. As she approached the Sunland Boulevard exit, she noticed a vehicle in her rearview mirror, which was approaching her vehicle at a very high rate of speed. This vehicle was driven by Rodney King.
Prosecutor White explains that several LAPD cars joined a high-speed pursuit. After a nearly 8-mile chase, Rodney King pulled over. White concedes up front that King disobeyed commands and resisted arrest.
Mr. King was being ordered to put his hands in view and to lie down on the ground. But Melanie Singer will testify he wasn't actually cooperating with that, at least not right away. She will tell you that Mr. King looked up at a helicopter which was circling the area and pointed at the helicopter and started smiling. All of this time, Los Angeles Police Department and CHP is ordering Mr. King down on the ground. Mr. King eventually did get down on the ground. He got down on the ground in a position where his arms were partially extended, his head was on the ground, and his entire body was on the ground, lying flat on his stomach. When he got into that position, Melanie Singer approached him to handcuff him to place him under arrest. When she made her approach, defendant Stacy Coon said, "Stop, we'll handle this." At that time, Melanie Singer will testify that Officer Powell and another officer went to Rodney King grabbing a wrist. Officer Powell grabbed one wrist, another officer grabbed the other wrist. She testified that she believes that was some type of control move they were trying to place on Mr. King, but it was done in an ineffective manner.
I'm going to pause it here. Just so you understand it, there are two jurisdictions involved. One is the state police, that's Melanie Singer and her partner. They're the first ones on the scene. The second jurisdiction is the Los Angeles Police Department. That's Stacy Coon. And it's Coon that takes over from the state police, and it's then his team that is on the spot.
Clapped their hands away and stood up. At that point, Sergeant Stacy Coon told the officers to back away, that he was going to use a taser. Now, the taser is going to be explained in this particular trial, but it is a device in which they can shoot 50,000 volts of electricity through a person. In this particular instance, the taser apparently was not effective for whatever reason, and it's going to be explained to you during the trial the reasons why it probably was not effective on that particular night. Now, after the taser became ineffective, Rodney King rose to his feet. And you're going to see that on the video when we play the video. As the video starts, Mr. King is lying flat on the ground. He then rises to his feet. He moves from left to right on the screen in the direction of Officer Powell. This could be viewed either as an attack of Officer Powell or running away from Officer Powell. By any interpretation, what Mr. Powell did next, you're going to see on the video, was unreasonable. Mr. Powell struck him a blow to the face with a baton. Much as a baseball batter would swing at a pitch, he swung that baton, hit Mr. Powell in the head. Melanie Singer will testify that the blow struck Mr. Powell in the head, causing the skin on his cheek to split, blood to spurt out. Mr. King goes down. Officer Powell then stands over him and delivers more blows to his head area. Also during the...
I'm going to move forward here, except I hope it allows me to do it. I want to get through. He basically runs through the evidence, and then the lawyers for each of the defendants gets up and makes their opening statement. And each one separately gets to make an argument, in effect. Let me just wheel through it. Okay. Oh, wait a minute.
President Bush and the mayor of Los Angeles condemned the violence seen on the tape. As its first witness, the prosecution calls the man who videotaped the beating.
My name is George William Holliday.
Without George Holliday, these four officers might not be on trial. Holliday says he was awakened by police sirens and helicopters, and he took out his new video camera to shoot the event. The full videotape, not just the short snippets aired on the news, is played in court. Parts of it, such as when King rushes at the officers, are blurred.
Thank you.
That's the whole tape.
For the record, the time of the end of the tape on the screen now says 12:55 and 44 seconds.
Next, the state calls Bryant Allen, a friend of Rodney King, who was a passenger in King's car that night.
At that time, did you know somebody by the name of Rodney Glenn King?
Yeah.
How long did you know him, Mr. King?
Well, King, but all my youth, like, well.
How long?
My youth, like 12. Yeah.
Can you speak up a little bit? Maybe a little
closer. This poor guy is so nervous.
All right. And on the evening of March 2nd, 1991, did you see Mr. King? On the evening of March 2nd, 1991, did you and Mr. King get together?
Say March 91?
Yes.
March 3rd, 91, yeah.
Allen's testimony seems questionable in some respects, and he can't testify about the beating. He was on the ground, hands cuffed behind his back, when King was beaten. On cross-examination, Allen is questioned about King's unusual behavior during the chase.
So you told Mr. King to pull over, and he didn't when you said it the first time, did he?
Right.
You thought he might have been in shock, didn't you?
Yeah.
What did you mean by shock?
But he wasn't doing it. I just got stuck to where he was doing.
Well, you thought he was acting pretty strange, didn't you?
No, I know he was acting strange.
You started getting more and more and more worried the less and less Mr. King listened to you, correct?
Right. Yeah, one time I wanted to just jump out the car, but I didn't want to do that. But I didn't think I'd done something.
Well, you thought he was acting kind of crazy, didn't you?
Huh?
You thought he was acting crazy, didn't you?
Acting strange, yeah.
That observation may actually help the defense, underscoring its claim that the officers had reason to believe that King was on the drug PCP. Next comes the prosecution's star witnesses, the husband and wife team of Melanie and Tim Singer, the two California Highway Patrol officers who initiated the pursuit of Rodney King's car.
As I reached the bottom of the hill, down the bottom of Summit itself, my vehicle was reading on the display at 115 and bouncing about 115 to 117 miles per hour.
Melanie Singer was the first officer to have contact with King at the scene. Singer describes him as initially uncooperative.
What happened after he placed his hands on the roof of the car?
When he placed his hands on the roof of the car, the helicopter was overhead. He then looked like he was saying something inside the car, then pointed up at the helicopter itself and began to wave at the helicopter with his right hand. With his left hand still on the top of the roof of the car.
Was he still smiling?
Yes, sir, he was waving.
Now, was he smiling or was he laughing? Or what was he doing?
He appeared to be smiling. I didn't hear any chuckles or any outward bursts.
And what happened next?
After he had began to wave at the helicopter, my partner yelled at him, "I told you, get back from the car, get your hands where I can see him, get yourself on the ground."
Now, other than your partner, officer who was issuing commands, had any other officer issued any other commands to the driver?
No, sir.
What happened next?
When he moved away from the car, he propped both of his arms away from the car, down to his sides, and turned his body almost in a north direction, away to where his left side was now facing me, to where I could not see his right hand. At that time, I withdrew my weapon, pointed it at the suspect, or the driver, told him to get his hands away from his butt. I could not see where his hand was. And at that time, he turned his complete body around to where his rear end was facing me. He grabbed his right buttock with his right hand and shook it at me.
Singer says she approached King with her gun drawn, but LAPD Sergeant Stacy Coon stepped in and told her he and the LAPD were taking charge of the situation. She says that's when Coon shot King twice with an electric shotgun called a taser.
Then Officer Powell came up to the right of him, and in a matter of seconds, he took out his baton. He had it in a power swing, and he struck the driver right across the top of the cheekbone, splitting his face from the top of his ear to his chin.
Prior to Officer Powell hitting him with the baton, did anyone give the driver any type of commands after this second taser shot that you described?
No, sir.
Was there any reason for the strike to the head by Officer Powell at the time he struck him?
In my opinion, no, sir. There was no reason for it.
Melanie Singer demonstrates the blow she says she saw Lawrence Powell deliver.
Cross-examination.
On cross-examination, Officer Powell's attorney, Michael Stone, tries to cast doubt on Singer's observations. Stone grills Singer about the apparent inconsistency between the blows Singer says she saw and the injuries sustained by Rodney King.
Well, you described in your earlier testimony, and then you just reiterated that the skin was split from the ear to the chin, is that right? She just said yes.
Objection overruled.
And does that appear to be sutured in that photograph?
I mean, sir?
Does that appear to be sutured in that photograph?
No, sir.
Does it appear to be split in that photograph from the ear to the chin?
No, sir.
Do you have any explanation for that?
I saw what I saw, sir.
Thank you.
Patrol Officer Tim Singer, partner and husband of Melanie.
This guy basically just repeats the same story. Doesn't really add anything.
King and Lawrence Powell.
During the course of conversation.
She's a nurse testifying about what happens when King is taken to the hospital.
Mr. Powell had said to Mr. King, "We played a little ball tonight too, didn't we?" And Mr. King replied, "I don't know," or "I don't know what you mean." And then Mr. Powell said, "We played a little hardball tonight. Do you remember who was playing?" And Mr. King said something to the effect, "I guess so." And Mr. Powell said, "We won and you lost," something to that effect.
My name's Lawrence Ernest Davis.
Nurse Lawrence Davis was also in the emergency room that night.
What did Officer Powell say?
Officer Powell says it's a good thing that I'm not going to the game. I wouldn't want you to be my usher.
And what did Mr. King say to that?
Nothing.
And did Officer Powell then say anything else?
Later on in the conversation, as I was doing my assessment, Officer Powell made a comment that he asked Rodney if he remembered that.
He asked who?
Rodney King.
Okay, please refer to him by his proper name.
Mr. King. Okay. He asked Mr. King if he remembered the game that they played that night, referring to themselves, the police officers.
What exactly did he say?
He asked, "Did you see the game we played tonight?"
And he was directed that comment toward Mr. King?
Yes, sir.
And what did Mr. King say?
Mr. King said, I don't recall, I don't know what you're talking about.
And what did Mr. Powell say to that?
He said, "Oh, come on, don't you remember? You know, we had a pretty good hardball game tonight."
And what did Mr. King say to that?
Mr. King didn't realize what they were talking about.
Mr. King did not reply to that?
Not then, no.
And did Mr. Powell say something else?
Yeah, he says, "You know, don't you remember the hardball game? We hit quite a few home runs." And then Mr. King, it dawned on him who they were talking about. And Mr. King said, "Oh, yes, I remember. You guys did have a pretty good ball game tonight."
The prosecution introduces more so-called state of mind evidence against Lawrence Powell. Messages sent by Powell to a colleague on a mini computer in his police car just after the incident.
What message was sent to 16A23?
The message that was sent to 16A23 was, "Oops, what?"
Then at 1:13 and 53 seconds in the morning, Unit 16A23 sent a message back to Unit 16FB9, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And what was that message?
The message states, "I haven't beaten anyone this bad in a long time."
The state's strategy is to portray Powell as a person who knew what he had done, knew it was wrong, and didn't care. Next, an audio tape of Powell's radio call for an ambulance.
Thank you.
Pollo's reference to King's injuries as numerous head wounds and his laughter afterwards is introduced as evidence of Pollo's inappropriate behavior. Now the prosecution turns to the state of mind of Sergeant Coon. A police car computer message was sent by Sergeant Coon to headquarters just after the incident.
The message that was sent to the ACC states, you, and that happens to be unit, just had a big time use of force, tased and beat the suspect of a CH pursued big time.
Prosecutors argue that when Sergeant Coon stated that Rodney King was beat and tased in a big time use of force, Coon was admitting that the use of force was excessive. Without addressing the state of mind of the other two defendants, the prosecution turns to a last important aspect of its case, the medical condition of Rodney King after the beating. Dr. Antonio Mancia treated King.
I'm just going to go through this. They basically said he had a whole bunch of injuries. And that's pretty much the prosecution's case. Now, what's going on here is an interview with the DA and really explaining why it is that they didn't call Rodney King as a witness. And basically they didn't call him because they were afraid of him as a witness. Wait one sec. Did I just go too far? Yes, I did. So now here we go with the defense case.
Predominantly white community can fairly judge four officers accused of beating a black man. With the venue change already working in his favor, the defense opens its case. Defense attorney Munger leads off. He ends earlier speculation as to whether the defendants would testify in their own defense.
My name is Stacy Cornell Coon. First name Stacy, S-T-A-C, Charles.
Coon, a 14-year police veteran, is accused by the state of supervising the beating of Rodney King.
And you said that you observed him to be bucked out. Would you please describe to the jury what bucked out means to you? Bucked out is jargon that I've come to associate with very muscular. In other words, an individual that is very pumped up as far as muscles. And does that have some significance to you?
Yes, it does.
And what is that significance? The bucked out. Yes, Your Honor, with regard to your state of mind, what were you thinking when you saw this bucked out person? My initial response is that he is probably an ex-con.
The CHP officer, Melanie Singer, began approaching the suspect with a gun in hand.
And how close did she get to Mr. King?
I had approximated about from your distance to the edge of the jury box there, about 5-6 feet.
And did you say anything to Officer Singer?
Yes, sir, I did.
And what was that?
I ordered her to stay back.
And why was that, sir?
Because she was injecting a gun into the situation, and my tactical training had led me to believe that you don't approach suspects that are not controlled with a gun.
Coon describes how officers tried but could not restrain King.
The next thing I saw is Officer Powell is thrown off of Mr. King, and Officer Persino is struggling to get away.
All right, when you say thrown off, can you describe for the jury what you mean by thrown off? What position was it?
Well, Mr. King's left arm was behind him, and Officer Powell was on his back. And Officer Bracino was trying to force the arm up to meet so that the wrist would match behind the cuff. And all of a sudden, Mr. King's arm just came out from him. And then he swayed to the left, swayed to the right, and Officer Powell was thrown off, and Officer Bracino kind of landed on his behind. I ordered him to back off, and then I tased the suspect, Mr. King.
All right, did you say anything to him before you tased him?
Yes, sir, I did.
What did you say to him?
He was on the rise, and I ordered him to get down, to go down.
All right, tell us what you mean by on the rise, sir.
He had initially gone out flat, and after the rolling motion, he had kind of come up to his left side, and his torso was off the ground, and his legs were cocked, and he was attempting, in my opinion, to rise off the ground.
And did you say anything to him?
Yes, I told him. I ordered him to lay down, to get down.
And did you say this in a normal tone?
No, I shouted it at him. I advised him, told him that didn't get down and kind of tase him.
All right. And did he stay down?
No, he did not.
What did he do?
He continued to rise.
And what did you do?
I tased him.
Did you see any physical movements of Mr. King?
No, he grimaced. He kind of gave out like a bear-like yell.
And what did he do then?
He continued to rise. He got up to his knees, and he began to turn 180 degrees toward me.
And what happened then?
I ordered him again to lay down, to get down.
And what did he do?
He continued to rise. He came up. He continued to rise to his feet, and I tased him a second time.
And what did he do after you tased him a second time?
He repeated this groan, similar to like a wounded animal, and then he, I could see the vibrations on him, but he seemed to be overcoming it.
Sergeant Coon then establishes what will become a major theme, the officer's fear of Rodney King.
I thought that the suspect was under the influence of PCP. PCP is a dangerous drug. It's kind of like a policeman's nightmare, that the individual that's under this is super strong. They have more of a one-track mind. They exhibit super strength, and they equate it with a monster is what they equate it with.
While both the defense and the prosecution agreed in court that Rodney King was legally drunk, there was no evidence of PCP use. But Sergeant Coon says it's what he thought that matters.
You see the officers giving a torrent of blows to his body?
Yes, to his arms, to his torso, to his legs.
All right, have you given any specific direction to Mr. King at this time?
I've been yelling at him to get down, to stay down at this time.
All right, and has he gotten down, sir?
No, sir, he continues to rise.
And what are you thinking now, sir?
I'm getting concerned, scared. I'm getting a little frightened now because this gentleman has just been subjected to a multitude of blows with the metal PR-24, and there is no evidence that he's going to go into compliance mode.
As Coon testifies, it becomes increasingly apparent that the defense is trying to use the tape for its own advantage.
Sergeant Coon, at this point in time, this incident has just gone on several seconds, is that correct?
It's gone on, it seems like an eternity, but it's gone on several seconds, yes.
All right, and Mr. King has been hit several times?
He's been hit a lot of times.
And at this point, do you believe he's trying to get up?
Yes, I do.
And what did you think he was trying to get up to do?
That he was going to get up and arm himself and possibly attack Officer Wind here in the background, Officer Powell, Officer Brasino.
During this entire incident, do you believe that you were in charge of your officers?
Yes, I was in charge of my officers.
Do you believe that your officers did anything improper?
Overruled, didn't answer the question.
No, this was a managed and controlled use of force. It followed the policies and procedures of the Los Angeles Police Department and the training.
So how do you view looking at this videotape, sir?
Overruled, didn't answer the question.
It's violent and it's brutal.
Was this anything that you enjoyed?
No.
Why was it done?
It's done to control an aggressive combative suspect, and sometimes police work is brutal. That's just a fact of life.
Your Honor, I have no questions.
Mr. Stone?
I have no questions.
Mr. DePasquale?
No questions, Your Honor. All right.
None of the other defense lawyers cross-examined Sergeant Coon, a show of apparent unity. But on cross-examination, Prosecutor Alan Yokelson tries to chip away at his testimony.
So you felt that you were responsible for directing the actions of all of the officers at the scene, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And therefore you would have responsibility for the actions of the officers at the scene, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And when you gave directions to the Los Angeles police officers there, you take responsibility for all of their actions, correct?
Yes, sir. I take accountability and responsibility for all the actions.
Those who were within the law and those who were without that are outside the law, is that correct?
Objection sustained. No evidence.
It's argumentative. Objection sustained.
When is deadly force authorized by Los Angeles Police Department?
I'm not sure what you mean by when it's authorized.
When can you shoot somebody under LAPD policy?
When they're an imminent threat to you.
What kind of threat?
Deadly threat to you. They have to pose
a deadly threat to you?
In other words, they have to be in a position to kill you.
That's correct, sir.
And what was Mr. King doing here that led you to believe that he was going to kill you or kill somebody?
It was my belief and my perception. He was under the influence of PCP. If he had grabbed my officer, it would have been a death grip. If he had grabbed the weapon, he would have had numerous targets, sir.
He didn't grab anybody during these events, did he?
No, sir, he did not.
He didn't kick anybody during these events, did he?
No, sir, he did not.
Is it your testimony that you were approaching the point where deadly force was going to be required?
Yes, sir, it is.
And your option would have been to shoot him?
To choke or to shoot, sir.
But because of what you've just spoken about with respect to the chokehold, your only option left would have been to shoot him, is that right?
Yes, sir. I personally would have applied a chokehold to Mr. King prior to ordering him to be shot.
So you would have gone in and used his chokehold, is that right?
I personally. No, I would not have delegated that to any officer. I personally would have done that.
The questions turn to the baton blows.
Is it your testimony that every one of these blows depicted on this videotape is a justified use of force within the meaning of the policy of the Los Angeles Police Department?
I can't honestly say that I saw every one of those blows that was on the videotape.
In watching the videotape now, is it your testimony that every one of the blows that you see on there is a justified use of force?
It's a reasonable and necessary use of the minimum force. Yes, sir, that is my testimony.
In all your years of experience, Sergeant, have you ever seen a worse beating applied by officers of the Los Angeles Police Department?
I've seen use of the forces of considerable violence, but I have not seen anything as violent as this in my 14 and a half years. No, sir.
It appears that the prosecution has made little headway. Coon stands by the actions of the officers on duty that night. To bolster Coon's version of events, the defense calls an expert.
Charles L. Duke, Jr., D-U-K-E.
Duke, a veteran of more than 20 years with the Los Angeles Police Department, helps establish a key defense strategy, turning the videotape to its own advantage. Duke meticulously dissects the tape, identifying the blows and kicks as direct reactions to aggressive movements by Rodney King.
What did Mr. King do based upon your perception?
Mr. King came from a outstretched, prone position, raised up and turned and would appear to run or charge at an officer.
All right, sir. And in this particular set of circumstances, is a baton an appropriate weapon to use to stop that advance or escape?
Yes, it is.
When he is in this position here at 3:36:19, would it be appropriate to hit Mr. King with a baton?
He's in a rising position. He has this leg is cocked. He's up on his knees, or up on his elbows, in a rising position.
All right, so you're saying based upon all that has happened up to date, with regard to this scenario, you think it would be appropriate to hit him?
Yes, I do, because once an officer is attacked, to allow the suspect to rise to his feet, you allow the potential for escalating the situation into a deadly force mode. The suspect has his hand in a flat, the hand portion of the hand is flat on the ground. The arm appears to be cocked. This leg, which would be his left leg, appears to be bent, coming up in a position, and he is in a rock, what appears to be a rocking position because of the bent leg here, and the arm flat on the ground in a pushing position.
Assuming that an individual perceived him to be attempting to rise, would it be appropriate within the policy and procedure to strike that individual?
Yes, it would.
Prosecutor Terry White challenges Duke's conclusions.
Sergeant Duke, when you first saw this videotape, you were shocked by what you saw, weren't you?
I wasn't shocked, no.
When you first saw this videotape, did you believe that it possibly contained excessive force by these officers?
I never form an opinion until I get all the facts.
Sergeant Duke, when you first looked at this videotape, did you possibly believe that it contained excessive force? Yes or no?
I'd have to say no.
White turns to the tape itself.
Stopping the video at 3:51:02, Mr. King is again on his knees, his upper body raised off the ground. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Now, in this particular sequence that we've just seen, from the point in time where it was started until now where it stopped at 3:51:02, have you seen Mr. King swing at anyone?
No, I haven't.
Have you seen him punch at anyone?
No, I haven't.
Okay. His only movement is up to raising off the ground. Is that correct?
Right, down the spectrum of the first incident that you referred to, he is in that spectrum of aggression.
Which would again allow the continued use of the baton.
That's correct.
This is still an aggressive position in your mind, is that correct?
Yes, according to your spectrum it is, yes.
Well, according to your perception, it's an aggressive position.
Yes, on the guide of your spectrum, yes, it's both.
Still aggressive enough in your mind to justify the continued use of this deadly weapon?
Yes.
What movement have you seen by Mr. King at this time?
He had his knee in a cocked position and the baton's blow struck and it straightened it out.
The baton blow straightened out his leg?
It caused him to move his leg straight in a straight position.
What do you think it caused it to move it in that straight position, from pain?
I don't know.
Does Mr. King need to be unconscious for you to say he's not aggressive?
No.
The prosecution has failed to shake you from his position that every blow delivered to Rodney King was specifically provoked by him. The defense hopes that this will be enough to create...
So I'm fast-forwarding through some more just expert stuff. The next thing of interest is Powell.
Here we go.
Ah, come on.
Back at a top.
Yeah, we get right back to the beginning. Okay.
Yes.
Prosecutor Terry White says Rodney King was not really resisting, but he is unable to shake Captain Michael from his conclusion. But it's the next witness who is the most anticipated one to take the stand in this trial.
Lawrence Michael Powell?
Lawrence Powell has the most to explain. He is seen hitting Rodney King over 45 times. Powell testifies about when he and his partner, defendant Timothy Wynn, joined in the chase after Rodney King's car.
I looked in to see how many occupants there were, could count three, and saw the driver and the passenger looking back at us at one point.
When you say looking back, were they continuously looking back?
At different times, and it wasn't all three turning their heads at the same time, but the passenger looked back. I saw the driver look back at a time, so the passenger looked back another time, and the driver, all their heads were going like little dolls. That indicated to me that they knew we were there, and that the police were behind them with lights and siren going.
Powell testifies about the first moments when he saw King.
I saw the blank stare, the slow, stiff movements, and he wasn't complying with the verbal commands, and I could see sweat glistening on his face.
Did his conduct concern, did his conduct figure into your evaluation?
Yes, it did.
And in what way?
And I was scared that this guy was under PCP.
In your mind, was it safe to approach him at that point?
No.
Why did you approach him?
Sergeant Kuhn told me to. I walked up to the left side of Mr. King and reached down and grabbed his left wrist and placed my right hand behind his neck on his back and tried to pull the arm out from underneath him.
What was your reason for doing that?
I wanted him to be laying on the ground so I could handcuff him. Mr. King took his arms
hand broke him free of my grasp and the other officer's grasp, put him down on the ground in a push-up position, raised up his torso, and knocked me off, and I fell backwards and landed on my rear.
When this happened, did that concern you?
Yes.
Why?
Well, I had all my body weight on top of this guy, and in a matter of a second, he had done a push-up and had knocked me off and wasn't complying with the handcuffing. He was resisting his fighting.
As you were struggling or tugging on his arms, were you assessing anything?
Yes, he had great strength and resistance in his arms.
You could feel that?
I could feel it and I could see. He had very powerful arms. This was a big man.
Was there ever a time when you stood facing Mr. King, both of you on your feet, where he is flailing his arms and you're swinging a baton in a forward and reverse power stroke at his shoulders?
No.
Was there ever a time when you were in those same relative positions and you swung your baton in forward and reverse power strokes and struck Mr. King in the jaw or face?
No.
Tell the jury what you remember about that charge.
Just remember, just real fast, I had no time to react. It was practically a head-on collision where I had to step aside and I had my baton out, but I wasn't able to swing it and
all
get
right,
in a swing.
Stop there. Now, when you say it was almost a head-on collision, was describe for the jury in more detail which direction Mr. King was coming toward you, if that was the case, and how you were facing him, if you were.
Yes, he was coming straight towards me, and I was facing directly at him.
All right. And what was the position of his arms?
His arms were up in a manner like this, about shoulder height, with his hands out.
You described his arms extending out from his body, his hands open?
Right. Okay.
And as he came toward you, was he moving slowly or fast?
Very quickly.
And tell the jury what you did in response to that.
I didn't have time to react. I was starting to swing, but it was more like a checked swing when he collided into me.
Right, after the collision, and did Mr. King continue to go in the direction that he was going?
Yes.
And were you able to watch him?
Yes.
And just describe what you saw.
It was like a ragdoll, no muscles, just everything quit, and his face just went in a straight crashing position and landed on his face.
What did you see next?
I saw his head bounce back up, and then his arms came in underneath him, and he went into a push-up position again, raising his torso off the ground and bringing his legs in.
And what did you do then?
I hit him with the power stroke on his right arm and yelled at him to get down on the ground.
Right. Now, why did you do that?
Because I didn't want him to get back up again.
Why not?
Because he's a danger. He charged me once, he attacked me twice. I've already been attacked, and he's getting up again.
Did you strike Mr. King for the purpose of punishing him?
No.
Did you strike Mr. King for the purpose of hurting him?
No, not for the purpose of hurting him.
All right. Did you strike Mr. King in anger?
No.
Describe your mental state at the time you were striking.
I was completely in fear for my life, scared to death that if this guy got back up, he was going to take my gun away from me, or there was going to be a shooting, and I was doing everything I could to keep him down on the ground.
Powell denies a prosecution claim that he taunted Rodney King in the emergency room.
Yes. Did you yourself say anything about hitting home runs?
No.
Did you say anything about playing baseball?
No.
About hardball?
No.
Do you have any conversations like that at all with Mr. King?
Just the usher comment.
So the answer is?
No.
All right. Did you have any conversations with any other
officer in that immediate area about any of those things that I mentioned?
No.
Under questioning by his lawyer, Powell has denied the prosecutor's allegations and has reinforced the same story Sergeant Stacy Kuhn told from the stand, that the force used was justified. But on cross-examination, Prosecutor Terry White focuses on Powell's possible motivations.
When you type something into the MBT, do you think about it before you type it?
Usually, yes.
Usually you think about what you want to type and then you type the word in. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Your fingers just don't go over that keyboard or the typing board involuntarily, do they?
No.
Your mind works before your fingers start working. Is that correct?
Yes.
White asks about a police computer message Powell sent just before the incident.
You replied to her, sounds almost as exciting as our last call. It was right out of Gorillas in the Mist. And that's what you typed into her, isn't it?
Yes.
And she typed back, ha 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 ha. Let me guess who beat the parties. You remember that, don't you?
Yes.
And then you typed in a message to her about trying to get through the night and that you were off for 6 days and it was time for some serious bike riding. Then you typed in, good guess, didn't you?
I believe so.
Now this incident that you're referring to, this last call right out of Gorillas in the Mist, it involved a family of African Americans, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
And in your description of these individuals, you called them gorillas, didn't you?
No.
Now, this call that involved these African Americans, was it in a jungle?
In a what?
A jungle.
No.
Was it at the zoo?
No.
Were there any gorillas around?
I didn't see any.
This is the movie Gorillas in the Mist, is that correct?
Yes.
Was there any wildlife around at all during this call?
Not that I saw.
Other than just these individuals who were African Americans, is that correct?
No, I wouldn't call them wildlife.
But you referred to that call as right out of Gorillas in the Mist.
Yes.
There were no gorillas there, were there?
No, I didn't see any.
Was that movie playing on their TV when you were there?
I didn't go inside the house.
Did you see anything regarding Gorillas in the Mist while you were at that location?
Did I see anything?
Yes.
No.
Again trying to discredit Powell, the prosecutor turns to the computer message sent after the incident.
Officer Powell,
you used excessive force when you beat Rodney King, didn't you?
No, sir.
Officer Powell, you used inappropriate conduct in that incident with Rodney King, didn't you?
No, sir.
Why did you tell Corrina Smith, I haven't beaten anyone this bad in a long time? Why did you use the word beaten?
That's a common police jargon when you talk from policeman to policeman, kind of a professional jargon.
Professional jargon?
Yeah.
So you go up to someone and say, how many people did you beat today?
I don't do that, no.
But you did it here.
No, I didn't do that.
Well, you used the word beaten.
Yes, I did use the word beaten.
Well, beat and beaten, the same thing, isn't it?
What do you mean, the same thing?
Same word.
Huh. Form of the same word, sure.
And that's professional police jargon in your mind?
No, it's jargon used in the police profession.
At any time during this evening, did it go through your mind that this was not a human being that you were beating?
No.
All right. Mr. King is a human being, right?
Yes, sir.
He should be treated like a human being.
Yes, sir.
Even though he is a suspect and even though he is suspected of committing a crime, this man is still a human being, isn't he?
Yes, sir.
He deserves to be treated like a human being, didn't he?
Yes, sir.
He wasn't an animal, was he?
No, sir, just acting like one.
He was just acting like one.
Yes, sir.
Was he acting like a gorilla?
No, sir. Okay.
But he was acting like one because of the sound he was making.
No, sir, because of his uncontrollable behavior.
You allowed this man, who you considered a threat, to get up off the ground and move towards you, didn't you?
I didn't allow him. He did that.
Okay. You allowed him to get up, didn't you?
I had no control. He did it.
Were you standing near him when he started to get up?
Not close enough to stop him.
Not close enough to stop him.
That's correct.
Were your feet frozen?
Were my feet frozen? Yeah. Oh no, it wasn't that cold.
Were your feet cemented in the ground?
No, sir.
You could have, as he attempted to get up, you could have moved toward him, couldn't you?
Yes.
You could have moved toward him and struck him to keep him on the ground.
Not in this situation. I couldn't have. I didn't have time.
Officer Powell, you wanted him to get up, didn't you?
No, sir.
You wanted him to move towards you, didn't you?
No, that's not what
you wanted to hit him in the head with a baton, didn't you?
No, sir.
On the stand for hours, Powell has stuck to his version of events. Ultimately, the question comes down to credibility. Will the jury believe his story enough to cast a reasonable doubt on the accusations against him?
All right, now I want to explain something to you. And then go back and look at the original video again. What the police officers are describing as the policies and procedures of the Los Angeles Police Department have to do with the use of force in arresting suspects. They basically divide the use of force into three categories. If you're arresting a compliant suspect, you're not allowed to use force. If you're arresting a non-compliant suspect who is threatening but not a deadly threat, you're allowed to use non-deadly force, which in this case is defined as the use of the baton below the head. And if the suspect is presenting a deadly threat, you can use deadly force, which consists of the choke or shoot. Right, that's the frame. Now within that frame, what the training dictates is described as force escalation. The idea is, the main objective is to keep the suspect out of the deadly force area, and specifically to make the person who's being arrested compliant, go into compliance mode, which means lie down on the ground, put your hands in back of you, and get handcuffed. So what they're instructed to do is, when they see a suspect moving towards compliance mode, they're to desist from applying force. But if they see the suspect moving up, that is, out of compliance, they're to use the maximum amount of force that's permitted within the category. So their basic structure and training is, they're ordering the guy to comply, lie down on the ground, put hands behind your back. When they see him going into non-compliance, they whack him, not on the head, but body with the baton. And when they see him stopping from getting up, that is moving back into compliance, they stop whacking him. That's their basic structure. All right, so now the story that the cops have put forward here, the police have put forward, is one in which it's important to understand that the Holiday video doesn't start at the beginning of the incident. We don't see the part of the incident where they tase him twice. We don't see the first time that he throws Powell off. In fact, when you see at the very beginning of the video, where it's all out of focus, that's exactly the time at which the charge takes place. You'll see as you look at it again, that's when you see King moving very sharply. He's gotten up a second time, he's heading towards Powell. That's when Powell either hits him in the face or doesn't, according to the conflict in the testimony. And then you see the video come into focus, and if you listen in the background, you can hear them shouting, "Get down, get down." And you watch this episode unfold, where they're whacking him into compliance and stopping when he's moving in that direction and whacking him when he's moving in the other direction. All right, so that's the basic context in which the defense wants you to watch the video. Now, let me see if I can get it back to the beginning and show you the video again. Is it in fact rewinding? So much, much else to observe and comment on in the case in terms of the lawyering that was involved. But it's really the videotape that I want you to look at and to see if you can see it in the way the prosecution is suggesting that you see it. Now let me just run through until we get there. So the cop story starts with an 8-mile high-speed chase through the Los Angeles night. Then a suspect that they actually tased twice. Can you imagine a 50,000-volt shot? And we've seen that that's happened twice before we get to the video.
And as any indication, he should be confident. Both President Bush and the mayor of Los Angeles condemn the violence seen on the tape. As his first witness, the prosecution calls the man who videotaped the beating.
Sorry, my name is George William Holliday.
Without George Holliday, these four officers might not be on trial. Holliday says he was awakened by police sirens and
right there, he's up,
and
he charges, wham, he gets hit.
To shoot the event. The full videotape, not just the short snippets aired on the news, is played in court. Parts of it, such as when King rushes at the officers, are blurred.
See, there he's stopping him. He's lying down. That's Prosciutto stopping him. As he's getting up, they whack him. Face down with his hands in the back of him. That's compliance mode. and that's basically it.
So the question that's posed as a jury matter there is whether the officers act with intent to impose excessive force. And the question is, are they guilty beyond a reasonable doubt? So I'd be curious if how your deliberations would come out. I'd be curious what your verdict would be. If he uses the baton to hit somebody in the head intentionally, that's the use of deadly force. No, not a problem. I shouldn't say not a problem. It's possible that there's some problem there. In fact, often assault with a deadly weapon, to wit a shod foot, is a not an atypical form of indictment. But that wasn't what the issue was here. Yeah, what do you think?
I think my problem, well, besides the obvious problems that violently beating somebody, is that they thought he was on PCD, which means they were expecting him to be overly aggressive and really not show the effects of pain so much, and also have, like, you know, your kids buried under a car string. So when they get him down on the ground for about a 5-second period where he's lying on his stomach and not really moving, that's when, if they were afraid he was on PCP, that's when they should have moved in and thrown cuffs on him, because if he was on PCP, he probably was going to get up again, if that's what they believe. And instead of holding him down, he starts, like, twitching his leg a bit, and they start beating his leg. And then he starts kind of rolling over, and they start beating him again, which is just going to incite him to try and get up and move away, because they're beating him. So you're not going to just sit there and take that. So, I mean, with the charging and the fact that he was tased a couple of times and didn't really go down, and he was in a car chase, force was like necessary at some point, but I think at a certain point I don't know if they lost control of themselves or they wanted to beat somebody, but at a certain point it moved from excusable force to excessive force.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't really like that argument, because I don't think they're on trial for failing to cuff him quickly enough. I mean, maybe they did wait too long, and I think that's a completely valid concern about them. But given that they had waited too long, and he was getting up again, I mean, it seemed to me that I couldn't say beyond a reasonable doubt that any of those blows weren't in response to some potentially aggressive move. I mean, I wouldn't convict this guy. Or any of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess for me, as a juror, I'd be weighing the question of, okay, we have all this evidence, and, you know, which story is plausible? And I think that the officer's story is plausible, and the prosecution's version of the story is plausible. So I think if both are plausible, then you have to accept that, you know, that if the defendant's story is plausible, then, you know, that's a reasonable doubt. And I think even with video evidence, it's kind of, you know, there might be a point where, yeah, he was lying on the ground, they were beating his legs, but yeah, I don't know if there's enough there to say with any certainty that, you know, there wasn't something that the camera didn't capture. And that's kind of interesting, given that you think, you know, with video evidence that it should be so much easier, and that it's not really that much easier having the video there.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, the contextualization of what happened within the kind of the guidelines of the police authority, what really kind of changes the way you view the case. And it's tempting to think about the guidelines themselves and think whether that's appropriate, but we kind of, as a jury, you have to kind of accept that that's what they were trained to do. And so you might have kind of an issue with the fact that you don't don't think that use of force is ever necessary. You think it might be excessive, but it might be okay within the confines of the structure that these officers have been given. And so you can object to it on a moral level and say you don't ever think that's going to be valid, but then you also have the problem that you don't necessarily want to convict, or you don't want to say something excessive if it's within a different kind of moral framework. And I think that's where the real problem comes. That's why, that's how the case kind of worked, because if you just get shown the video, then it's almost, you want things in a no-brainer, it's too much. But having this different structure, which you're not familiar with, you don't quite understand, you've not gone through the training, if you add that into it and you're trying to, you know, assess it within that, then it makes it more difficult and introduces doubt.
Yes, for sure. Yes.
I was thoroughly underwhelmed by the prosecution. I got the sense, and maybe this is just my sense, but I got the sense that they were trying to portray the officers as sort of malicious from the start, whereas the evidence that I found most compelling was the sort of the text messages and like the comments that they made at the end, which it seemed to indicate that they were, you know, at least not very remorseful at the end. I'm with you. I find it very difficult to believe that these officers sort of like jumped in, you know, with the intent of like trying to beat this guy up. I found the evidence on the defense, you know, I found the defense's case just more compelling that, you know, they didn't come in with this sort of intent, and maybe it turned out that they did use excessive force, but I just found sort of the character, the mental state, the character attack from the beginning to the end to be a little bit implausible.
Yeah.
One of the things that the guidelines that they were referring to, are those guidelines for when you're two officers with your partner dealing with a guy? I mean, in this case, one thing that struck me, there's six officers standing around this guy, and, you know, it seems to me that the threat that he posed could not have been of the magnitude that would justify that kind of being. When you've got six guys there that theoretically be able to restrain him in other ways, I didn't understand why, you know, could someone have, like, tackled him or something else aside from, like, sort of the vicious beating with the nightstick. I mean, that to me is really what struck me with the video, and I can understand the argument that, you know, they're following procedure, and that creates some sort of doubt as to whether this was excessive force. But I mean, I question how reasonable that data. I mean, at the end of the day, if there wasn't this video and you had the factual situation, what would the outcome be? I mean, I'm not sure that anyone would say there's a reasonable doubt, and maybe part of the video is sort of a two-edged sword in a way, I guess, for the prosecution in a way that you wouldn't think it would fit, which I was
I think there's more than six there. I think you can count, I recall counting up to 11 people standing around. But then there's the question, is the idea that everybody jumps on at once, so it's like a pylon? And in fact, when Kuhn was told about the video, supposedly, he was pleased when he first heard about it, because he thought that this was an extraordinary incident, and that it would be almost like a training film in terms of the application of force. And in fact, he when you look at the thing, he's definitely standing off and back, giving orders, and there's various people around watching what's happening. And it does have this kind of quality of almost a dance. And I gather that it is part of the procedure that you don't, that you use two men, and more gets in the way rather than makes the problem easier. So he's actually got people standing back, and the guy with the suit, Casino, is actually in there, actually supervising, hands on, in close, kind of directing the other two. So it has this quality of being directed. And to me, the thing that's so striking about it is when you first see the video, you don't really focus on that part of it at all. But when you find out what the directions are, you can see it that way. And it may be overboard, just as you're suggesting. And in fact, these guys get acquitted on this trial. And this is the state proceeding. And Los Angeles then goes up in a riot with the acquittal. And the feds then come in and initiate a second prosecution under federal law. And in the second prosecution, they do a bunch of things differently. They call King amongst other things, and they don't put the emphasis on the cut that doesn't seem to be there when you have the photograph. And they get a prosecutor who knows how to ask a question. I mean, we can talk about the quality of the cross-examination. It's utterly abominable. My favorite is when he asks Duke, the expert witness. He starts off with Duke saying, you were shocked when you saw this video, weren't you? And I don't know, what does he expect Duke to say? He's the guy's expert. He's going to say no. And when he says no, the prosecutor is almost like he didn't expect the answer. So it's a little bit strange. And the result in the federal trial is that they get convictions of Kuhn and Powell, and they both go away. And their conviction is basically on just what you're pointing out. That is, there was the lull where he's on the ground. And it really does look like they finally got him down and they could have jumped on him and put the handcuffs on. But no, it goes on for a little bit then. And so there's some 15 blows of when after that, and they kind of premised it on that. But nonetheless, the thing that I'm so eager to have you see is, here is this piece of evidence which can be so damning when you see it in one light. And yet, by focusing carefully on the reasonable doubt aspect of the question, and then reframing the evidence so that the context in which you are processing it is different than it was to start with, you actually change the reaction. This goes back fundamentally to a psychology that actually has been worked out as much as anything in the drug field by drug psychiatrists, where they talk about drug set and setting. The idea is that you can't tell what the reaction is to a drug unless you know the mindset of the person who experiences it and the context in which they experience it. And it's those three things that make up the reaction. It's not just the specific chemical. And you can extrapolate that to all of evidence. That is, the item of evidence doesn't mean anything by itself. Evidence means something in terms of the mindset of the person who's observing it and the context in which it's observed. And so much of what lawyering is about is taking evidence which looks a certain way in a certain context and reframing the picture so that suddenly it looks different. Yeah?
Something that the defense did extraordinarily well and that the prosecution did very badly was kind of focusing on emotion and these images of, like, they kind of focused on how strong his arms were and the sweat glistening on his face and kind of the power that he had and created this visual image of this kind of, you know, scary, strong, intoxicated individual. Whereas, and they brought experts in to kind of talk about how police are normally, you know, afraid in the situation. They talked about the kind of fear the officer had. Whereas the prosecution didn't really kind of focus on maybe bringing in an expert of you know, maybe someone who's been beaten by six officers, or, you know, talk about the perspective of Rodney King as being on the ground and having people beating you and created in a different visual and
Well, that was their choice in not calling King, which seemed in retrospect to have been a tactical mistake. And he, in fact, testified in the federal trial and stood up fine as a witness. And yes, you're perfectly right. There's a whole lot of artistry in the presentation of the defense witnesses, which some might well think was underhanded. There's a suggestion of animalism. It's almost like a play on racism that's implicit in the bucked out, and he growled like a bear, and you could see the ripples on him, and there's definitely a flavor that they're playing on of the black man in the night as the frightening person, and using it with what in that case, the single most outrageous feature of that case was that the jury that they selected was all white. We didn't concentrate on that part in it, but this was a case that arose in Los Angeles. The defense then succeeded in getting a change of venue motion to Ventura County, which had a significant black population, but nonetheless, in the jury selection, they wound up with 12 white jurors, which meant that there was no verdict that was going to be satisfactory coming out of that case. Just that's just not what a jury trial was possibly about. And they were definitely playing to the suburban white fear of the downtown, late at night, high speed, drugged up, large black man. And no question that that's a rift that's running through the strategy of the defense. Yeah, and you can make excuses for the prosecutor. When you think about the prosecutor's problem, this is a journeyman prosecutor who every day has as his witnesses in court the police. The police are the prosecutor's witnesses. And here, all of a sudden, he's prosecuting the police. And he's not just prosecuting, you know, rogue policemen. It's perfectly clear that Stacy Kuhn, within that department, was a tremendously respected person. And yes, there's very definitely artistry in the way both Kuhn and Powell present on the stand. They're both extremely practiced witnesses. They were very meticulous in the way they answered the questions. And Kuhn in particular, has been coached with what you might call the empathic approach. That is, he's not underplaying anything. He keeps surprising you by telling you how violent this was and how extreme in many respects it was. So he's not trying to underplay you at all. He's going exactly the same way. And when he gets the opportunity to say, I wouldn't have delegated that to man, I would have stepped in and I would have done it myself, that's like his opportunity to present character to the jury. And in its way, it's juxtaposed with the prosecutor who really, and I would say really both prosecutors, they just didn't seem strong in the way they're coming out. They were into wordplay games rather than somehow a strength position. And so the defense quite well succeeded in opposing character and in having a logic to their defense that the prosecution really hadn't seen and didn't anticipate, and then executing it in a way that put it across in a quite effective way. So I don't know whether this works. I mean, the thought that I have as a teacher is that this feature of empathic argument, this willingness to put yourself in a mode where you actually can feel it from the other side, is so important. And yet, as an abstraction, you really don't get it. But if you actually experience it, you feel yourself having been moved by the tactic in a way that at least lets you see the evidence different from the way you saw it at the beginning, you get the feeling of how significant the idea of changing a person's context can be. And to me, that's just core strategy. You put that in the bank for just about every tough case you will come across. All right, so I put up on the web a piece of reading, which I want to ask you to read for tomorrow. It's on our wiki. And again, it may seem a little off, but I'm in terms of cyber, it's not cyber, it's argument. What it is, it's an essay that was written by a man named John Doerr, who is one of my heroes, my mentors, about the history of the Voting Rights Act in the United States and how it got passed. And Doerr was the head of the Civil Rights Division when I went there to the division. But this piece really describes the years prior. The year I was there, actually, the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965 as a part of the Johnson administration. And I was there in 66. I was actually an observer on the first vote under the Voting Rights Act in 1966. But this is really the story of how this act got passed. And it starts against the background of a mindset that, in effect, is the result of slavery and the Civil War. It's really a story of how the voting structure in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama had become entirely entrenched in a way that excluded blacks from the vote. Virtually 100%. And the technique by which it was done was that a qualification to vote was that you had to demonstrate an understanding of the Constitution. And so part of the procedure for registering voters was to have them asked a question about the Constitution, and they would write out an answer on a form. And then that would be judged by the voting commissioner who was in whatever the county was, and this was all done at a local level. And it was the case that no black person passed the test, and every white person passed the test. And this was entrenched and built into the power structure in these states to a point where it was just absolutely lock solid. And so what this essay does is it tells you the story of John F. Kennedy becoming president, although that's way in the background, but Bobby Kennedy becoming attorney general, and the initiation of a strategy, a litigation strategy, that ultimately led the Congress of the United States to pass the Voting Rights Act. It led first to the conversion of federal judges in the South who start out totally opposed, and then eventually becomes the basis on which the Congress passes the Voting Rights Act. And what I'm interested in you absorbing from it is, again, an element of changing the context, using the facts, painting a picture that the other side can't get away from, and the strategy of actually using the law as the vehicle for doing it. So that, to me, John Doerr, who's extremely modest, and I'll tell you some John Doerr stories that kind of illustrate his use of the strategy, but here it's spelled out in this essay, and I hope to focus on the importance of the facts and of the willingness to engage them as the basis for creating the empathic frame. So please look at that tomorrow. We'll come in and we'll talk about it. We'll do some little group things, and that's where we'll be tomorrow. So, adios. How many of you could see this thing from the cops' point of view? Now, you don't have to agree with it, but how many of you could see it the way the cops were seeing it? Yeah, good.